These Ndnaz ascetics fasted, and during the course of their fast and other physical exercises, destined to keep their bodies absolutely pure, they were, of course, intensely conscious of their bodies. Their exercises really seemed to amount to a strange kind of dissociation of man's consciousness by concentrating all his awareness into his body. It was a most unusual experience to meet people in Tibet who took so great care of their bodies. Painstaking care for them seemed to be a kind of fixed idea with this special type of ascetics. They considered butter as not pure enough for cleaning their bodies and replaced it by mustard and oil, the price of which is much more than the Tibetan multitude can afford. If someone concentrates his whole attention on his body and in doing so uses various choice things, the price of which is exorbitant, it is small wonder that he is more selfish in his everyday life than the ordinary individual who does not turn the care of his body into a religion. These Ndnaz ascetics are not very numerous, and provide the usual way of cleaning one's body in Tibet is by rubbing it with a pat of butter. Many a reader will no doubt smile at this, but the author has found that butter really has an excellent cleaning effect on the body. Soap has been used in the West only during the last few centuries, and the ancient Romans, who were very clean people, since the number of Roman public baths was large, used oil for cleaning their bodies. Also, mustard and egg yolk seem to have a remarkably strong cleansing effect on the human body. A strange contrast to the Tibetan multitude, who entirely neglect their bodies. From time to time these ascetics fast during considerable periods, but why do these people fast? Because they want to be spiritual, happy and healthy, and because they expect that they will be able greatly to prolong their lives by taking good care of their bodies. I had to think of a Western health apostle whom I happen to know. He is about 60 years of age now and has taken the greatest care of his kidneys for 40 years by carefully avoiding food which would not be good for them. He now has a serious kidney disease which seems to have been brought about by his continual fear for his kidneys. Surely spirituality cannot be attained by physical practices. On the other hand, it is just as foolish to neglect one's body. I thought that these Ndnaz ascetics badly needed a good dose of common sense. Chapter 4 The UNDERGROUND City of the Initiates IKNEW from Narabu. That the City of the Initiates was an important center situated in the Valley of Mystery at a distance of about 20 miles from the nearest village. I wondered again and again how a whole city could keep unwelcome visitors and the curious multitude away, all the more so as Narabu had told me that the city was not surrounded by walls or ditches and that it was not even guarded, an ordinary Tibetan monastery being infinitely better protected than the city. I known of the smaller side valleys of the Sangpa Valley, I could not get over the temptation of casually asking a young Tibetan farmer whether he had ever heard of the Valley of Mystery. He looked at me in a very strange way and replied, me. But there was something in his whole attitude that made it seem probable for the attentive observer that he did know something about it but was reluctant to talk. The Valley of Mystery was less than 3 days' walk distant, and if there really was a city inhabited by many hundreds of people, it was improbable that he had never heard of its existence. Surely the Valley of Mystery must exist, I insisted, for I am going to IT. No L95, he gave a start and then observed, almost tremblingly, in a very low voice, of course, most of us know that the city exists. But it is an unwritten law that none of us should ever speak about it, or even mention its name. I know the way, I said, once more examining Narabu's sketch drawn with the accuracy of an officer on a Western general staff. I do not want to make you talk, as I shall soon find out all about it myself. Tell me only why you are not allowed to talk and who forces so many thousands of people to hold their tongues. Dreadful punishment comes automatically to all those who break this rule, he answered. We know this by experience. Last year, two friends of mine passed on some rumors they had heard about the city. They were both taken very ill the same evening, and all their cattle died. The same and even worse things happen to all those who try to get near the city out of curiosity. Did you ever try it? I asked. No, he replied, and this is the last question I can answer. I never went there, but a friend of mine tried it. He had passed the borderline marking the precincts of the city and returned some time later to join his friends who had accompanied him. He looked 3 years older and had become mute. He could not speak for 3 months. His tzbi was paralyzed. I went on my way. I was not inclined to take the story very seriously, although the peasant had seemed greatly frightened. Once such fears get a firm hold of a whole population, autosuggestion becomes a mighty factor. Why should a powerful degree of autosuggestion not bring about disease and paralysis? I had found cases of this kind in other parts of the world. Days later I approached the city of the initiates. I was in the valley indicated in Narabu's sketch. At a place where it was about 100 yards wide, the river bed suddenly disappeared. Here stood a few large stone slabs displaying the word border chiseled into the stone in large characters. So this was the borderline the Tibetan peasant had mentioned to me. I passed on. The valley beyond the stone slabs looked exactly like the area on the other side of it, with the difference that the riverbed had suddenly disappeared. I walked several 100 yards farther, but no city came in view. A few 100 yards farther on, the valley gradually widened, but still no city was visible. I began to wonder whether I had lost my way. When I had walked a few more minutes, I suddenly noticed a circular stone wall measuring about 4 feet in height and about 10 yards in diameter, erected in the middle of the valley where it was about 400 yards wide. The ground very gently sloped from that circular wall in all directions, and in a much wider circle, the radius of Tamdot which was perhaps 100 yards, there were 7 quadrangular railings. I approached. The nearer I came, the more I could see how tidy and remarkably well kept everything seemed to be. Then I noticed that the 7 railings enclosed 7 quadrangular patches of ground entirely covered with large slabs made of glass. The area of each quadrangle was about 40 by 40 yards. In front of each quadrangle, a staircase led underground to a substantial door. It was obvious that the 7 quadrangles were so many residential buildings built into the ground, the light coming in through flat glass ceilings on a level with the ground. I at once realized the idea of the designer of these strange houses. It would be easy to keep them warm in the winter. At the same time, the city would be practically earthquake-proof, and as the roofs were on a level with the ground, it would be sufficient to cover the glass surfaces with sand and to remove the railings and the little wall in the center to make the whole city disappear in cases of emergency. In the worst event, even the staircases could be covered up. The light of the morning sun made the glass surfaces glitter, and I began to wonder how the inhabitants protected themselves from the scorching rays of the sun in the hot summer afternoons, when I noticed a large pipe leading up to a kind of tank in the circular wall in the center, which was situated at the highest point of the gently sloping plain. Smaller pipes ran out from the tank towards the glass surfaces, and it was probable that on hot afternoons the temperature of the houses could be kept down by a continual flow of water over the glass roofs. I went down one of the staircases and stood before a heavy door. There was no device at all by which a visitor could signal his presence. I knocked with my fingers and a little later with my fist. But no one came to open. I had the idea to get on the glass roofs and trample in order to wake somebody, but found that this was quite impossible as the railings were more than 8 feet high, very substantial, and so ingeniously devised that climbing over them was impossible. So all I could do was to stroll about, looking for someone. But nobody was abroad. I seemed to be in a city of the dead. And yet it was perhaps 9:30 in the morning. I decided to take a little walk to examine the neighborhood, hoping to meet someone on my return. I walked out of the city in the opposite direction, but once I was beyond the railings of the last glass surface I was again in the desert, and 1/4 mile farther on the were other stone slabs again displaying the word border. That was all I saw. I turned round to walk back. The city of the initiates lay before me at a distance of 100 yards, but had I come there for the first time unaware of its existence I should not have noticed it. The thin railings, which were exactly the same color as the ground, were hardly visible, and the circular wall was hidden by a little ridge dot. When I had returned I saw somebody come up one of the 7 staircases. It was not necessary to call him. He came along to meet me with great rapidity. "Kyle, are you Doug?" he asked sharply. He wore a chupa made of cheap silk and was scrupulously clean. His eyes were very cold. There did not seem to be any expression in his face. "I have been invited to come here," I answered. "By whom?" His voice sounded almost hollow, and was impersonal in tone. I mentioned Narabu's name. His cold aloofness at once gave way to great respect. "It is too early, sir, very few people in the city get up before noon. Life here begins in the early afternoon. If you have been invited to come here, Lamochunj will know about it. You must wait. Perhaps she will come out from the palace in an hour. What do you want here?"
"The palace," I exclaimed.
"Yes, the palace," he repeated.
"That is the palace."
He pointed to one of the quadrangular glass surfaces. He bowed respectfully and passed on. During the whole conversation his eyes had remained quite aloof. I looked at him while he walked away. Another man dressed in cotton came up from another staircase. I did not like his gait at all. I could not help thinking of the doll in a well-known operetta by Offenbach. There was no life about this man, not a shade of individuality. The coldest valet having lived for years with the coldest aristocrat in the world would be a volcano of life and feeling in comparison with this man. When he passed me I got a glimpse of his eyes. They were almost glassy, like the eyes of a corpse. To use my time I once more examined everything very carefully. I had not yet explored the wall and leaned over it. It was built round a vertical shaft. I looked down, it seemed to be enormously deep. I strained my eyes. Down it went, and seemed to disappear in the bowels of the earth. I looked for a stone. If I threw down a good-sized stone about 10 pounds in weight I could ascertain its depth, I thought. The city was so tidy that not a single stone covered the ground. I had to walk at least 5 minutes to fetch a few good-sized stones. I threw one of them down into the shaft and listened. 10 seconds passed and there was no sound. 20, 30, 40. 50 seconds passed and yet no sound came. I threw down a second heavy stone and leaned over the wall. There was no sound at all. I walked towards the mountainside a second time and fetched a big stone weighing at least 20 pounds. I pulled out my rubber boat from the bag made of sheepskin in which it was hidden and with the help of strings and safety pins turned it into a large earphone. Fastening it to the wall of the shaft, the wide opening turned downward. I then threw down the heavy stone and listened through the earphone with the greatest attention. 10 seconds passed, then 20, then 30. No sound yet. I was in the greatest suspense. After about 35 seconds I heard the sound of the heavy stone as it savagely tore along the wall of the shaft. The brushing against the wall continued for several seconds,
but by the 40th second it had not yet struck the bottom. I listened through my earphone for another minute but did not hear the faintest sound. Surely this was an interesting object of study for any explorer, and I walked once more to the mountain side and returned with a piece of rock weighing a little over 30 pounds. At that moment another Tibetan ran up to me from one of the staircases, saying, "My lord, our guest, you are respectfully requested not to throw stones into the shaft." He looked at me icily with his glassy eyes and walked away. Soon afterwards, the city seemed to awaken to life. People came up the various staircases, most of them humbly dressed in cotton gowns. A few others were dressed in silk. The inhabitants seemed to belong to two different categories. Those dressed in silk moved about like human beings. When some of them passed me while I stood leaning against the wall of the shaft, they greeted me without, however, stopping or putting any questions. Their faces were rather handsome in most cases, and a few women were very beautiful. Only their eyes had a kind of dismal expression. None of them laughed, and those who talked to each other while they passed from one building to another spoke in an exceedingly low voice. The people wearing cotton chupa were quite different. They were more numerous than the other variety and seemed to be the servants of the colony. There were even children belonging to that Kate Gorey. This class of people was rather horrible to look at. They behaved like automatons and their eyes strangely resembled the eyes of corpses. I began to feel a little uncomfortable. But then I thought of beautiful little Dolma so full of life and enthusiasm, and of Narbu, who was so clever, energetic, and kind-hearted. Could such people introduce me to a body not serving the purpose of light? Had I not been told that the city of the initiates took a stand for the most lofty principles? Did it not work to help the world? And then everything about the city seemed to be so tidy, so practical, so remarkably well organized. The very plan of the city bore the unmistakable stamp of genius. A few children dressed in cotton garbs passed the wall, carrying heavy packages. A little girl dropped a parcel just while she passed me. I stooped to help her to pick it up. Our eyes met. I had never seen such eyes in a child. There was no life in them, no joy, no enthusiasm, only the monotonous expression of a mechanically working intelligence. She took the parcel without saying a word or smiling, and passed on. Again I had to think of a robot or a wandering corpse. At that moment one of the adult automatons, dressed in a chupa, approached me, gazed at me lifelessly and said, "My lord, our guest, Lamo Chun Vertical Bar will meet you at the entrance of the palace." I walked to one of the staircases directed by the lifeless servant. A young lady, elegantly dressed in pure white silk of excellent quality, ascended the staircase and met me smilingly. "Welcome," she said in a very low voice. "We knew that you were coming." "I arrived here this morning," I replied in Tibetan, "but had not the pleasure to meet anybody at first." "We rise very late in the holy city," she replied. "Breakfast is served in the dining house," she pointed to one of the other glass roofs, "at 1 o'clock. All our members and guests are present then." She glanced at my equipment. "I shall have these things transported to your room." She beckoned to one of the servants dressed in cotton. Only once I met two children in the city who seemed to be really alive. They were probably child of members, Tibetan gown. The little goddess Chupa, who got hold of my belongings, "You will live in the guest house over there." The servant walked away with my things. "You are the second white person who visits the holy city," she said, and then she added in broken English, "There have been several people here from India, but only one from the West." "Has he returned?" I asked, this time in English. "Oh," she answered.
Unfortunately, he died here. He is buried in the holy city. WOULD it be too much to ask you to have someone show me his grave tomorrow? I hazarded. By no means, she went on in fairly comprehensible English. I will show it to you myself. We walked a few dozen yards to the next staircase. This is the temple building, she said. We call it Lakang. She pulled out a golden key and unlocked the door. Please, my lord, step in first. Decidedly they were very polite in the holy city. We entered a corridor. The light was almost too strong for one's eyes, the whole roof being made of glass, and brilliant daylight flooding in through the whole ceiling. She unlocked the heavy door opposite and threw it open. The walls were covered with strange magic signs and songs. This is the dead house, she said. When someone dies in the holy city, his or her remains are kept here until burial. For how long? Magic formulae. For 7 days, answered Lamo Chun. There are 3 floors in this building, she went on. The dead house is on the top floor, our temple is on the floor just below it, and the burial place is on the floor under the temple. We walked out and she carefully locked the door. On going downstairs we passed the door of the temple, which seemed to consist of massive gold. Perhaps the layer of gold was superficial, but even in that case the illusion was complete. I am sorry I cannot show you the temple, she said. Only the members of the Holy Brotherhood are allowed to enter, for guests' special permission of him, our prince, is required, but he is not in the city at present. We went downstairs to the lowest floor. The light in the corridor was very dim as it came successively through 3 glass ceilings. She again pulled out a golden key and unlocked a large hall. This is our cemetery, she said. You will find the grave of the Westerner in the corner over there. It is the second from the right. I walked up to the stone slab. A Tibetan name was written in it. I read it very carefully but found that it did not sound Western at all. He was probably buried under the Tibetan name by which he had been known in the city. I was lingering before a few other stone slabs when she said, if you like I will show you rapidly the other buildings. As he is absent, I can even show you his private garden. If we hurry up a little I can show you all the buildings in the holy city except, of course, his palace. I hope he will grant you an audience when he returns and then you may see this too. We went upstairs, and she took me to the building situated on the other side of the palace. When she opened the heavy door I could hardly believe my eyes. There was a large hall measuring about 40 by 40 yards full of delicious flowers. The glass house was just as good as any of the best to be found in botanical gardens in the West. The hall was divided into various compartments, kept at different temperatures by hot water pipes. The greenhouse was nothing exceptional in itself, but it seemed to be almost a miracle to find such a thing in the Tibetan valley. This is his private garden, she said with the deepest respect. This is where he, our prince, Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jeweler prince of light, deigns to take his afternoon walks. The glass house is directly connected with the palace by a subterranean passage. We had entered a compartment where tropical plants were kept. May I ask you what kind of fuel you use in the holy city in your central heating system? We use alcohol, she answered. It burns smokelessly. From where do you get it? We distill it ourselves. The distillery is in the building just opposite. The building is used for distilling, cooking, washing linen, centers of sanitation, and as a residential building for several hundred servants. We left the glass house. The building over there is the residential house of our members, she said. You will live in the guest house. Opposite. You can come and go as you like. You will see the dining building very soon, when we take breakfast. I will now show you rapidly the building used for cooking and sanitation. We walked over to the other building and went downstairs. A heavy door stood wide open. There was a large announcement which proclaimed that members, guests, and servants had to use the sanitary conveniences in that building, which was connected for that purpose with the other buildings by subterranean passages. Would it not be more practical to install sanitary conveniences in each of the other buildings? I ventured to ask the superintendent of the building, a middle-aged man wearing a cheap silk robe. "No," he said. "There are occult reasons for this strict rule. All impure organic matter here instantly goes into a fire kept burning day and night. Everybody in the holy city must go to the inconvenience of walking a few hundred yards from his or her building to this one. This is a sacrifice brought to the purity of the holy city." In saying so, his tone denoted considerable contempt for impure organic matter. I could not help thinking that respect of the Creator automatically implied a deep respect for our own bodies, and that the contempt of physical needs was nothing short of a sin. Up to that time I had maintained a very critical and matter-of-fact attitude about everything I saw or heard in the City of the Initiates. Strange to say, after taking my first meal in the dining building I stopped viewing things in this manner and suddenly became enthusiastic about everything in the Holy City as if I had swallowed with the food a strange capacity for uncritical enthusiasm. Several hundred members and guests of the Holy Brotherhood were present in the dining building to take breakfast. The meal was served in a large hall measuring about 40 by 40 yards. There were many elevated platforms, the participants being seated on them in circles of 9 people each, each person sitting on an expensive cushion of the very highest quality. Dozens of those dreadful lifeless servants, whom I greatly disliked until I had taken my first meal in the Holy City, moved about noiselessly on thick carpets. The food was sent over from the kitchen and sanitation building through an underground passage. Everything seemed to be very well organized. Servants came and went at regular intervals, and one of them even seemed to regulate the traffic. Some of my readers will have wondered how the Brotherhood obtain the means of living. If only a few dozen out of the several hundred members of the fraternity were about as wealthy as Narabu, all expenses could be met out of their voluntary contributions, all the more so as it is highly probable that the servants of the colony receive no wages at all. Furthermore, the perfect organization of the Holy City tends to reduce expenses by rendering waste impossible. As to the food supplies to the city, only a portion of the actual needs of the Brotherhood seemed to have been purchased from the outside world. There were vast underground halls covered with glass which were not accessible, and these may have been used for growing some food on scientific lines. The number 9 seemed to be the holy number in the holy city, although 7 also frequently occurred. There were 7 buildings, the guest house had 90 guest rooms. The gong was sounded 9 times before meals, etc. A few of the members could speak broken English about as much as Lamo Chun, and 2 of them happened to sit in my circle. When I saw the servant regulating the traffic at the entrance to the passage leading to the kitchen building, I cracked a joke about the city having an equivalent of traffic constables in the West, and accompanied the jest by a laugh. The others looked greatly shocked. I was at once politely but very firmly informed by a kind of superintendent dressed in cheap silk that laughter was forbidden in the holy city. I then learned from the other members in my circle that not only laughter but also speaking in a loud voice was a breach of the rules. Only conversation in a low voice was tolerated. Among the people seated in my circle many were clairvoyants. They were very proud of their occult achievements. They also felt proud that they had been selected by Mani Rinpoche, the exalted jewel,
to serve him in the great mission of bringing illumination to the world. The exact hierarchical order of the members of the Holy Brotherhood headed by the Prince of Light or Exalted Jewel, occasionally briefly referred to as him, was a secret.